Welcome to the program for Friday, January 31st, 2014. It is the last Federal News Countdown of January of this year. On In-Depth with Francis Rose, Sean McCauley and Nicola Grisco, the producers today, Internet editors Michael O'Connell and Jack Moore, and my experts on this week's Federal News Countdown, John Desenberg of the Performance Institute. Good to see you, my friend.
It's great to be back. You know, it's 51 degrees outside. It's beautiful.
It's fantastic, and thank you for the weather update. We'll have you. Yeah, the only problem is you have to do another one on the 8th.
Okay.
So
as long as I get to do it outside.
We'll see if we can work that out. That might be feasible. And Dan Mintz of ESEM Consulting is here. And you and your friend Tom Suter are involved in a thing that I think you should tell me about, because you've explained it to me before, and I'm not sure I get it every time.
So it's called AMARC, the Advanced Mobility Academic Research Center.
Yes.
The goal is to create a community of interest among academicians to be involved with government around mobile technology problems. So we hold a bunch of summits. We get academicians together with the government. We're going to be starting a national app challenge for students to develop apps around government APIs and the critical infrastructure associated with DHS.
That's very cool.
Yes. We're looking forward to doing that over the next year.
Congratulations on that. And it's a neat initiative. And I am glad that you're here today on the Federal News Countdown. We start where we always do, with number three. And the third most important federal news story of the week, as selected by John Desenberg, is from FCW. And I have to give you a hard time about this a little bit. I am flattered that you chose a story about an event that I moderated. The headline is Initiative Aims to Find and Fix Federal Inefficiencies. But as I mentioned, these are the three most important federal news stories of the week, meaning this week, and this event was actually last Thursday. Maybe Frank didn't get this out until the weekend.
That's right.
And then we can let it slide in.
Yes.
But what did you think of the event? Because I saw you there.
Yep.
What did you think of the event, and what do you think is the news here that we should be paying attention to?
Well, first of all, former Comptroller General David Walker is someone who I've admired for a long time. You know, everyone knows he's usually the smartest guy in the room. He was talking about the deficit and the budget before it was in vogue. He's certainly ahead of the curve. And to hear him now talking about performance and results and outcomes, does someone from the Performance Institute, it does my heart good to hear someone talk about this. And he's created a great new organization called the Government Transformation Initiative.
But I knew that was coming.
Is a but coming. And the but is this. We in Washington feel that every problem needs new legislation. You know, people aren't managing well. Let's write some new laws. And maybe another law on top of that and another law on top of that. We have a Government Performance Act that tells agencies to do a good job. Then we need another and another. And the point is this, simply. Rather than create a whole new commission and a new board and new structures and new rules and a whole nother layer, why aren't we focusing on talking to management, talking to managers, talking to people out there in the field, and working like other businesses in this country run, which is, if you want to manage better, talk to your managers. If you want executives to make better decisions, why don't we investigate why they're not making better decisions right now? And let's just do something about it. You know, I think maybe I've lived in this town too long, but why do we have to introduce legislation for every little thing and a new committee and a new board? Frankly, the problem is poor management, people who are afraid to experiment and come up with new ways of delivering service. Why don't we look at the problem, get to the heart of the matter, and deal with it? You know, this is nothing that anyone opposes. This is not a partisan issue. I can't imagine why we need yet another law. Frankly, this kind of thing has bounced around Congress for over 20 years. Once upon a time, it was called the Sunset Commission, based on something that was going on in Texas that has been successful. But, you know, it is frustrating, and Dan, I'm sure you've seen this as well. When we can't manage here in Washington, we think we need to create yet another board that will do it for us, and we need to get out of that habit.
The sense that I took away from this that makes this different than what we've seen before, though, John, is the idea here is that this group would create – this would be kind of a process like BRAC. Since Congress can't agree because they don't want to make tough choices on their own, this board would do it, and then it would be an up or down vote, and it would give the members coverage to go back and say, well, I didn't want to do this one thing that affects us, but there are so many other things here that affect every place else that I had to kind of, you know, eat this to go along with the rest of it. And that's what strikes me as maybe being a little different.
Yeah. You know, but what is that saying about us as a country where Congress cannot do their job effectively, so we are going to kind of take them out of the loop?
Well, that's not a newsflash, my friend. It's not a new development, unfortunately.
Yeah, and you know, I think for BRAC this worked well, but BRAC was an insular-specific topic to open the same kind of commission up for all government programs and decisions seems to be a little bit of a different matter in terms of depth and breadth.
John Desenberg's third most important federal news story of the week is from FCW. The headline is Initiative Aims to Find and Fix Federal Efficiencies. It and all of our stories are linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Now, Dan, when I look at the stories every week, I normally think to myself, that's a good one. This is a good one. Glad that story was selected. Very seldom, though, do I take true joy that someone selects a story. And I am very pleased, very happy that you chose this story. It's your third most important story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. My colleague Jason writing, Railroad Retirement Board sets strategy to move off COBOL. Yes, to people who are hearing this and saying, surely he's not talking about COBOL. Nobody uses COBOL anymore. People use COBOL still. And the Railroad Retirement Board, Jason writes, finally on a path to ditch the programming language, but moving away from mainframe computers and the computer language first developed in 1959 will take some time. COBOL, for heaven's sake.
So speaking as a former COBOL programmer.
Yes. So why does that not surprise me?
So this actually, the story goes in a lot of different directions to me. So on the first part, which is the story itself, they talk about they decided they wanted to get off of COBOL.
It's a good idea.
One of the reasons is a lot of the employees have been working there on COBOL for 30 to 40 years, and they're getting ready to retire.
Uh-huh.
In case people are wondering about the upcoming federal or the ongoing federal retirement problem.
Yes.
And this is true at a lot of other agencies where you have people have these old programs. They don't do it. The other thing is they need mobile access to data, and they don't feel that COBOL provides that. And so those are the two main reasons. So that touches the HR thing. But just so you'll know, there was an article in Federal Computer Week in the end of last year, just in December, where they pointed out that right now the estimate is that approximately 70% of all business transactions today are still performed by COBOL programs.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding you. 70%. So you have all these back-end systems still running on mainframes and other computers, not the front end, the stuff that works with the PCs or your Android or your app iPhone. Are still running old COBOL programs, and they also have the same problem. All their COBOL programs are retiring. The other thing I will say that I guess the metaphor I take from that, the lesson I take from that, is that we're so one of the things that came out of a lot of the colleges that we work in is that the term they used, they're not teaching COBOL anymore, you know, duh. And the reason given, though, it's uncool. You know, we're all excited about you know, all these mobile apps and things like that. But there's a lot of people who are still in the workforce that aren't used to this kind of stuff. And there was an article related to this that talked about all this new development that a lot of people can't use in the same way people have difficulty getting off of COBOL. On one of the Android developer sites, I won't mention the company, one of the three goals is for developing new software is make me amazing. And the question is, what does that mean for modern people? So the reason the article resonated with me is it's a commentary on how people miss the fact of what's really going on. There's still a lot of old stuff that's there. There are employment issues in the federal government, but also that we need to keep track as we go to all this new stuff, that we need to transition slowly and take the people who use this old stuff along with us.
Somebody that was close to the construction of healthcare.gov said that was part of the problem. There is that the different agencies use different databases and different formats and so on, so that when the hub tried to pull data from all of these different things, some of them were very old. I don't know if COBOL was involved with any of these. But you had a brand new, just written hub that was trying to connect with legacy systems that had varying degrees of efficiency, and some weren't even designed to interact with other applications. They were just designed to be databases for those individual agencies to use.
Yeah, that actually touches on the next story that will come to that I have. But if I believe that people underestimate it, the importance of data consistency. It is not a COBOL issue in that case. It is the inability to translate data from system to system, which could be done with anything.
Well,
but there's not enough emphasis on that.
Yeah, and it speaks to the fact that various agencies have done things at various times throughout history, and that trying to bring them all together at one time is could be a very long, intense process, because you don't know at what station throughout time each operation has done whatever it's done that you now need to plug into.
But if you come up with a data standard that has been agreed to by the agencies, those standards tend to be sticky. They stay over time, so that all new systems, when they are developed, will use that same data standard. If I ran the world, and my wife reminds me every day I don't, if I ran the world, one of the things I would emphasize if I was at OMB would be data standards, and that would be one of my top two or three initiatives for the reasons we just talked about.
Dan Mintz's third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. Railroad Retirement Board sets strategy to move off COBOL, and you can find that story by Jason Miller and all of our stories on the countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later today. The second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Dan Mintz and John Desenberg when the Federal News Countdown continues next. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week has the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by John Desenberg of the Performance Institute and Dan Mintz, VSEM Consulting, and we're up to
number two.
Dan Mintz, your second most important federal news story of the week is from FCW. The headline is White House Seeks to Defang Transparency Bill, and we talked about this on Federal News Radio earlier in the week as well. What exactly is your sense that the White House wants to do to this transparency bill, and why is this noteworthy?
Well, we actually touched on this in the first article. It seems that the White House wants to decrease the effectiveness of it, make it a little less transparent. And it's a shame, because a lot of this stuff started when then-Senator Obama, when I was at the Department of Transportation, then-Senator Obama and Senator McCain were the ones who started a lot of the collection of data and the goal of having transparency to show grants and the status of grants and things like that. So part of the issue seems to be that they're not as interested in transparency to the data. The part that really struck me that I thought was important was also their desire to decrease funding for data standardization. And to some extent, I think part of the reason for that is, you know, their budget pressures. And I think that's it's underestimated. And this has been not just this administration. It's been continually underestimated, the importance of having data standardization across the government. And when I've been on here before, I've talked about the NEAM standard that was started initially between the Justice Department and DHS, is now expanded. And these are what are called XML standards. For those people who don't understand, that's a term used for allowing easy transmission of data between different computer systems. And it allows many agencies in those specific fields to transfer data from systems that are themselves different, but the data is consistent. And the value of that is that allows it saves a lot of money. It allows data to be transferred back and forth. All new systems can use these standards. It's what I call sticky. Once you define the standard and you say, and you go through the pain of having a common data standard, that standard tends to be followed on an ongoing basis.
The idea that you would have information, that you would do something that could consolidate data and make it easier to use and find, sounds like something that's right up your alley, John. What do you look at when you see this?
Well, I think we all know and understand that this whole concept started with the Recovery Act. I mean, the Recovery Act era, remember that, it was a big success because it was so transparent. You could go down to your zip code. You could see where the money was spent. And the real value in this is for fraud detection, right, and for tracking money. What this whole theory doesn't get at, which is what's the money actually doing for us as citizens, which is my, you know, and I think at the Performance Institute, what we're still looking for is let's move beyond fraud detection, which is what this kind of thing does, and let's get into the habit of results. Are we seeing progress towards the country's biggest issues? Are we getting kids to read? You know, are people going back to work? Instead, I think what a lot of these bills focus on is what I would call kind of a cynical view of government, which is we need to root out fraud and people pocketing money. And, you know, based on the experience with the Recovery Act, there was very little fraud. The real issue is not fraud or where's the money going. The real issue is what are we getting for the money? What's the result of the money? And I still don't think that data.gov or this law gets at that key question.
Yeah, I'd go a little bit further. I agree 100%. But in addition to that, I think in the long term, it'll save money because you spend a lot of money over and over again trying to integrate all these systems. Once you have these data standards set up, it allows you to spend less money as you move forward in terms of the IT spend.
The elements that this story says the White House wants to remove are the data standardization issues that you talked about, Dan, and you mentioned the funding stream that would be removed under the White House's changes. Senator Mark Warner, one of the sponsors of this bill, is very unhappy about this and is saying, essentially, don't touch my bill. What do you think will happen as this progresses? I mean, I have not heard of any champions in Congress for the White House's changes. It seems like they're kind of off on their own island on this.
Yeah, I think it'll go forward as is. The problem you have with these kinds of legislation, unless you have somebody who's really pushing it, this does seem to have some strong sponsors. It's not sexy. It's uncool.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really important. You know, again, I'm not denigrating things like cloud first and this first and all these kinds of things, but this is the meat and potatoes of government activity. One of the big things government does is generate and use data. And these standards are critical to get the government to be efficient in terms of how it operates. But unfortunately, it's often not at the top of the list of things that generate a lot of headlines.
How important do you think the funding stream is on this, John? If that does come out of this bill, does that make a big difference in how this is done? Because you can potentially try to pipe the money in from someplace else.
You know, I don't know this as well as Dan. I can't see a huge difference. Let me tell you, and maybe, Dan, you can react to this. The Performance Institute, we work with a lot of state and local governments, many of whom get federal grant dollars. What they tell us continually is that the reporting requirements are ridiculous. Even if it's a relatively small amount of money, the amount of reporting they have to do to the federal government and then maybe to their state as well are just onerous. Many governments are turning down federal money at this point because the reporting is more expensive than the value of the grant. I mean, does this get at that issue at all? When can we relieve some of these small groups of the burden of reporting?
So just answering your – there's two things. So answering, Francis, your question – about the data. I think the funding is only part of the issue. It's going to be whether the people at OMB think this is important enough to push. I don't think this has been high enough on the priority list. If it was, then I think that oomph would cause movement. The issue you're bringing up, which I think is a growing issue, there's a lot of federal programs where a lot of these things cross boundaries between the federal government and state government, federal and local government. And there have been some notable success stories. EPA, for example, I think does a very good job in terms of data collection from states. But there's been a lot of failures that way. Again, I think one of the things that would help would be an emphasis on making it easy to transmit the information and working between the IT groups to allow information to be standardized. Because the problem is not just that they're required to do all this reporting, but that every agency requires some of the same data to be reported in a different way.
Yep.
And that's one of the reasons that's a problem. So I believe that data standardization and a greater emphasis helps in a lot of different directions.
Dan Mintz's second most important federal news story of the week is from FCW. The headline is White House Seeks to Defang Transparency Bill. John Desenberg, your second most important story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is Microsoft Abolishes Employee Evaluation System. Now, employee evaluation has been a bugaboo in the federal government, probably since there was a federal government and somebody said, hey, we should keep track of how our people are doing. Why does this jump out at you? And is there a potential parallel here for agencies?
Exactly right. Exactly. You know, and it's not, why am I talking about Microsoft? Well, there's a very important reason, which is the biggest companies in the world, not just Microsoft, but there are others. And by the way, I talk more about this in my new weekly column at FedManager.com, the performance pickup, by the way. I talk about this issue in more in depth. But most big companies are finding that their employee appraisal processes are so badly broken that they're literally abandoning them. And we in the federal government for years were told, why can't you be more like the private sector? They know how to rate employees. They know how to look for results, and high performance people get, you know, raises and poor performing people get weeded out. And why can't you, the government, be more like Microsoft? Well, guess what? Microsoft isn't doing very well at this either. And that's because there are some basic structural problems with all employee appraisals. And more data, there's some research on this recently at the Harvard Business Review. Number one, managers are terribly subjective, and what the research shows is they do not do a good job objectively appraising their employees, which is just what we've heard in the government for years, mm-hmm. that this is unfair. I mean, you know, I know that both of you remember the National Security Personnel System of 2005 through 2010. May it rest in peace. 5 years and hundreds of millions of dollars later, DOD had to walk away from that because they just couldn't make performance-based appraisals work. And they couldn't make it work for very many of the same reasons that Microsoft can't make it work. Mm. Employees feel that it's unfair and subjective. Well, guess what? They're right. Research shows that they are very subjective, and managers are not good at this, number one. Number two, it's very, very time-consuming to compare people's ratings and have these rating panels and make sure people are being fairly treated, and especially in the federal system where merit and fairness is a very important value. And, you know, number two or number three, grade inflation, what we used to call grade inflation in high school. If you don't use a bell curve and force people to be distributed on that bell curve, what happens very quickly is everyone becomes excellent. Everyone's a 5 out of 5. And then the only way to deal with that is to go to some kind of bell curve, which is a big no-no in the government.
Right.
And in Microsoft, what the HR manager said was, how can you use a bell curve when every year you're getting rid of your worst employees? Because eventually all that's going to be left are your good people, and even then you're going to have to put those people on the bell curve.
Yeah.
So these are huge issues, and why I put this in here, Francis, is because we need to understand, I think, sometimes in the government that some of these performance issues, they're not just government problems, and I feel there's a big stigma that we endure here in the federal government, which is, again, why can't you do this the way business does? Well, you know what? Business isn't doing this very well either. And I hope people take some solace in this, that this is not just a government problem.
Do people, Dan, do you think, run too quickly to criticize the government for doing things without looking to see whether the private sector is succeeding or failing at the same things, as John points out here?
My take is that people miss the – yeah, first of all, yes. But people miss the fact that the government and business is not the same.
Mm-hmm.
You can use some business practices to improve government performance, but the value system, the strategic planning, the reward system in government, the definition of goals are different in government than in private industry. So that, first of all, they're going to be different. And just taking the private industry practices and putting them into government, well, I don't think work without thinking through those differences.
Right.
So that's the first part. But the second part, I agree 100% with John. I was talking to him before the show a little bit. I worked for Sun Microsystems for 11 years, and we wrestled with this, I know, year after year. You know, Scott McNeely got on the board of General Electric and came back and said, okay, we're going to do it the way General Electric does. We're going to rate everybody, and the top 5% will fire. which is the way general, that's the General Electric right. plan.
The bottom
5%.
Okay, I was going to say.
Well, that would have been an interesting approach.
Yeah.
No, the bottom 5%, it's Friday. Bottom 5% will fire. Well, that didn't work so well because no one wanted to do it.
Right.
One last piece of research that's coming out on this, which is just this week, what the research shows on employee appraisals is even your high-achieving people come out of these once a year, twice a year meetings disengaged and unhappy because any kind of critique that comes at them, they, you know, put their head down and they become disengaged. The bottom line is this, and the Harvard Business Review has spoken about this. We're going to be talking about this more, by the way, at the Government Performance Summit this year, where Federal News Radio is a partner, May 6th and 7th.
We'll look forward to it.
Yeah, you know,
we're jacked up.
The bottom line is this. Employee appraisals are important, but not really for the employee. They're important for the company or the organization to figure out who has skills, who doesn't have skills, where there are gaps, who needs to be hired, who needs to be let go. It's important for the company, but this myth has been pushed around, which is you employee, this is good for you to know. You know what? It probably really isn't that good for the employee.
We got to get out. But your second most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. Microsoft abolishes employee evaluation system. And while you were talking, I did go on fedmanager.com and scrolled down and found the performance pickup. So I have something extra to add to my reading list.
Thank you.
All the time.
Every
How
week.
Often do you post?
Every week.
Every week?
Every week.
Wow. So I've got something else to add to my list. All right. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by John Desenberg and Dan Mintz, is what we'll do when we come back on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The most important federal news story of the week is where we are on this week's Federal News Countdown.
Number one.
John Desenberg, your choice for the most important story of the week is from CNBC. The headline is Goldman Sachs hedge fund billionaire backed $27 million social impact bond. And as I read through this, I don't see anything that's obviously a federal government story. So I need you to translate for me.
Well, I sure will. You know, about 12, 13 years ago when I was a federal employee with the U.S. General Services Administration, we started talking about a concept called share in savings, which means that, for instance, if we're retrofitting a building, we're not going to pay the contractor until we start seeing savings in our monthly energy bills. And that's the way we would begin to contract out. We would pay for results. We're not going to pay for your time or activities anymore. We're going to pay for results and real outcomes. And it sounded great. Well, it never has worked out at the federal level. I've been told that there are acquisition issues and procurement issues and issues around the FAR that have prevented this from happening. But just this week, I received a phone call from the city of Denver, their performance improvement officer, who has worked with the Performance Institute, and he said, you know, we're moving to this social impact bond where we're going to do just what we've always talked about with you guys, which is we're going to pay for results and we're going to pay for outcomes, and we're not just going to pay for effort. We're going to really put our money where our mouth is and make it results-based. And he explained to me that venture capital funds are willing to invest in things like prisons and youth programs and literacy and all of the things the government should be doing. And they're willing to invest in this and bring best practices in and scale up promising practices that have already worked in other cities and states. And they're willing to do this, and they're willing to do it and front the money themselves without even being guaranteed that they'll get the money back from the government, because they feel they can bring results to these government programs, and they have some pretty ambitious targets. If you read the story, they're not paid unless they see some pretty substantial results from things like recidivism, which is a huge issue, people coming back into the prison system year after year. Well, these venture capitalists feel that they will invest in this issue, and they can change that, and they are willing to bet on it. The reason this is so important is this. We are banging our heads here in Washington. People like David Walker, who I mentioned, very upset that we're investing in programs that aren't working, very upset that we continue to spend money year after year in activities that are not producing results. and look at what's happening in state and local government, which I continue to see as we work with state and local governments around the country. These are the great laboratories for government because these people are willing to step out a little bit. They don't have as many rules as we have here in Washington. They have strong mayors who are willing to put their credibility on the line and experiment and try things like this. And here in town, we need to pay attention to this stuff. Just because an article like this doesn't say federal government doesn't mean that this isn't something that could be coming very soon to us here in Washington. And in my belief, it should be coming here because this is what we've been talking about for years. Let's pay for results. Let's get better outcomes. And let's be more effective stewards of tax money.
Dan, in a time when we talk more about public-private partnerships, this concept is tremendously interesting. Goldman Sachs, hedge fund billionaire John Arnold, and other philanthropic partners funded the largest ever social impact bond Wednesday, a $27 million effort to prevent young men in Massachusetts from going back to jail or prison. Goldman Sachs is essentially the senior lender for the bond and will be paid back the $9 million that they are contributing, plus 5% annual interest, if the project achieves its targeted impact of a 40% reduction in incarceration. Junior lenders Kresge and Living Cities will be paid their base, plus 2%. This is exactly what governments want right now. It's what we hear in Washington that the federal government wants, which is, hey, somebody else, usually it's vendors, but in this case it's the lenders, you take the risk, we reap the benefits. The benefit that the government would reap is a 40% reduction in incarceration and all of the associated costs and social benefits that go along with that. Is this something that you think could work at the federal level?
So I have two comments. The first comment is on the plus side, that there's a lot of this kind of activity is happening in pieces. So, for example, one different examples is when you've seen privatization of toll roads and things like that, where the private company takes over the risk of managing the road. And the local government or the state government can generate revenue from and often a lot of revenue from it. There's a certain amount of work, though it's in its infancy, in terms of using cyber insurance to try and achieve better cybersecurity, because insurance companies are very, very good over time at understanding risk. I mean, that's their business. And that might be a mechanism to improve security where all these policy issues wouldn't. So those are all – it's very interesting. On the downside is we're schizophrenic about this. On one hand, this all makes sense. It sounds good in terms of these kinds of conversations. But, for example, in Pennsylvania when they tried to do this, it was very controversial and was shot down because people didn't want to turn it over to – this public good into a private thing. You see a lot of public policy where on one hand people say they want to use these initiatives, but when push comes to shove, they're very uncomfortable with private industry implementing these public policies. You know, healthcare, for example, without trying to take a side in terms of what's good or bad, you can see this schizophrenia between how much of it should be publicly provided, public run, and how much should be privately provided. And there's a lot of argument in the country over all these things.
You know, Dan, the one thing I would differ with you on is with the toll roads, there was no tough problem to solve. The government just simply didn't have the money to put up to build these roads. So that's a little bit of a different issue. In this case, with recidivism, this is a problem that the government has been unable to solve for years. So, you know, after 10 years, 20 years, 30 years of terrible recidivism rates, it's time maybe for someone else to at least try it, don't you think?
Well, I think funding is an ongoing problem. But yes, I do agree that there are hard public policy issues. But I still believe the controversy, the schizophrenia over is it a good thing to use private approaches to public policy is still at the end going to be a hurdle that people will have to overcome to make these successful.
John Desenberg's most important federal news story of the week is from CNBC. The headline is Goldman Sachs and hedge fund billionaire backed $27 million social impact bond. And it's posted later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, like all of our stories on this week's countdown. Dan Mintz's choice for the most important federal news story of the week. We'll wrap up this week's federal news countdown next on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by John Desenberg and Dan Mintz. And Dan, your choice for number one this week is from the New York Times. The headline is U.S. Relaxes Some Data Disclosure Rules. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, and James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence, say the new declassification rules were prompted by President Obama's speech on intelligence reform earlier this month. This is a very weighty issue that the government is really struggling to figure out which direction to go in, it seems to me. Am I reading it wrong?
It's very complicated, and this is the for news people, the gift that never stops giving.
Yes.
Ed Snowden. I this week nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize.
What is that all about?
Well, you know, I have nothing to add to that comment. I'm sure the fact that this came up had everything to do with the speech and nothing to do with the lawsuit that Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and Facebook had brought against the United States in a FISA court to change the rules. So I'm sure they had nothing to do with it. And the fact that after they came out with this, they dropped the lawsuit was purely coincidental.
That's an interesting string of pure coincidences.
So it's interesting. Again, the broad issue, which we may have time to get to or not, is, of course, the issue of privacy and data collection and what's good or bad. The details of this article was that these companies are now still not going to be allowed to say what was released, but they are able to say that they were asked to release something, and they can release quantities. There's two kinds of requests. There are requests that the FISA court, which is this secret court that the government is supposed to go to ask for information, to ask permission to get information. And then there are what are called national security letters. So the FBI, an FBI agent, could go and use a national security letter without going to the court and ask for a different kind of information. So they can allow information 1,000 at a time. So if they had 7 requests or 999 requests, they can say they had between 0 and 1,000. And if they had over 1,000, then they can say, I had over 1,000. And they do that every six months. So that, at least they were allowed to do that. Interestingly enough, again, just with the story, which shows you that the free market always works and for advantage, one of the requirements that these big companies are that's still in there, startups are not covered by this for 2 years, for the first 2 years of their existence. So NSA can still get information from a startup for the first 2 years of existence without any information leaking. And there is some perception that this is now going to hurt startups, because at least you'll know whether the larger companies are giving out information, but the new ones, you won't.
What this really boils down to is the relationship that individual people, John, have with their personal information.
Right.
And it strikes me that for all the hullabaloo that we place around this issue in Washington and the people who pay attention to this stuff on a daily basis place around it, the average citizen on the street who types into Facebook everything that they do and every location that they go to and all their personal information except for maybe social security number. I mean, they ask you for your phone number, and they ask you where you work, and they ask you for your email address and assign you a Facebook email address and on and on and on. And a vast majority of people into the 90% range don't care. They don't care. They're willing to exchange. And I'm not criticizing that, because it's a transaction. You receive the benefits that you perceive to go along with posting on Facebook. And you and I are friends on Facebook. Yeah. And Dan, you and I are friends on Facebook. So we all enjoy these benefits. And we have provided some level of information to them ourselves to be able to participate in that dialogue.
I cringe. I'm one of the people you're just describing. And philosophically, of course, I'm against this kind of thing, just like we all are. Big picture, we're all against it. But really, who cares, right? You know, the government, I'm not doing anything wrong. And yet I cringe when I hear people say that, yet I'm one of those people. Mm-hmm. You know, my question for Dan really is, I've been on this show before where the talk was all about the cloud and the cloud this and the cloud that. And I guess my question is this going to cause corporations who have trade secrets and other things to start avoiding the cloud? I mean, is this going to have an effect on the trend towards moving everything up there?
So the answer is no, it will not stop this transition. Everything is moving in that direction. The complication is going to be, once again, we're schizophrenic about this. I would argue, by the way, it's not that we don't care, it's that we don't think. We just, in a sense, do it.
Okay. And all right, I see the distinction, and I agree with that distinction.
Yeah,
yes.
We're schizophrenic. On one hand, we want all the advantages of this kind of stuff, and on the other hand, we don't like the fact that a lot of the things we're doing now become exposed and correlated. And you have a lot of policy issues that are going to be – it's going to make it very complicated for global stuff because, for example, the European Union is reacting to a lot of this. You're going to find – one of the questions is going to be, is this going to negatively impact global trade, which is bad for the world economically, where Brazil is saying they're going to keep all their data locally because they don't want the data to be available to NSA. And ultimately, global trade only lives well if you have complete flow of information. And so that's the problem, I think, in the long term.
I'm going to change my mind back to my original declaration, which is that we don't care, because I think you're right that we don't think when we initially give the information. But John and I are now educated consumers, and you are too.
Still don't care.
And we could choose to go on to Facebook and change the privacy settings, or we could choose to not use a Google account, a Gmail account. And we do anyway. So, yes, I think you're right that most people don't think when they initially join whatever it is that they're joining, the Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, Facebook are the ones named in the story who were on this suit. I think that – so you're correct about the initial part of it. But as people become more educated, most people
still don't
continue to do the same behaviors.
In my opinion, if there wasn't a legal $50 limit on how much money you could lose using your credit card, you'd care.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
That I think people don't realize how important that limitation was in making electronic commerce viable. And because no matter what you do, as long as you report it, mm-hmm. $50 is the most that you can be out. And unless they actually steal your bank account, which is not as likely. That's your worst payment problem.
It's certainly much more difficult. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dan Mintz, is U.S. relaxes some data disclosure rules. It's from the New York Times, and that story and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later today. John Desenberg, congratulations on the new column on Fed Manager. I thank you for calling my attention to that.
Performance pickup.
And Dan Mintz, it's great to see you. And plug your app challenge in 10 seconds.
We're interested in people who would like to sponsor it or be involved with it. We're going to do it nationally over 2014.
Website?
www.amarcedu.org.
All right. Terrific. It's great to have both of you here on the Federal News Countdown. Dan Mintz and John Desenberg. Hour number 2 of In-Depth with Francis Rose is coming next on Federal News Radio.